Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And today we are back for part two of conspiracy theories. What they are, what can we do about them, what should we do about them as scientists in particular. So, Shahir, since this is your topic, I'm going to let you pick it up where we left it off last time.
Sounds good. Well, we talked a little bit, part one. If you missed it, I encourage you to listen to it. We talked about the different types of conspiracy theories, the different ones that are out there, top 10
of all which time. I believe one of them.
Apparently,
it turns out.
We all have some conspiracy theories that we believe in. I talked about mine, of course, as it was soccer. And, you know, it's part of who we are as humans. You know, we want to be part of a group and we want to feel like this group is superior. So in some ways, I mean, we're not making excuses for people using bad science here, but we're really interested in the motivation here about, like, why do we all believe in some sort of conspiracy theory? But I think the big question here, or the questions that we're hopefully trying to ask in this second half would be, does it matter? You know, are conspiracy theories helpful? Are they hurtful? Are they harmful? And what can we do about that, especially as scientists or science communicators, people who are actually going out there and talking about the science, communicating it to a general audience? So what do we think? Does it matter whether people believe that the Earth is flat or vaccines don't work or they make you autistic or what do we think?
Like I said in part one, I don't get too worked up about some of these. You know, I think flat Earth is a really nice example, because what is the harm of somebody believing in that or believing that there's a conspiracy to cover up that the Earth is flat?
I can think of some
I'm finishing my thought. I'm trying to be thoughtful about how I say it, because I know I don't want people to be like, well, it does matter. I understand the ways it does matter. I am saying from a Maggie Fink interacting with flat Earth guy who came to the bar when I was bartending. That conversation, I do not care about changing his mind or having a conversation that's rooted in that type of motivation. It does not, I do not think this, it does not change my opinion of that person, because I know, like I said, I personally believe and do things that are weird that other people might not understand. However, I do agree with what I'm going to assume you're going to say is it does matter that people don't believe things that are not scientifically accurate. Typically, if they, if somebody's a flat earther, I'm assuming there's a likelihood they're going to have some not scientifically accurate ideas about vaccines or, you know, public health policies and things like that. So I think it can kind of snowball to not address some of these things in communities. And flat earth is an easy one to talk about because it is like kind of really ridiculous that somebody would believe it. But I'm, you know, that's not a motivating factor for me to care about the community, engaging with science in a healthy way. I'm not there. And even vaccines, which we know work and are safe and effective. I'm really not out there to change somebody's mind to get a vaccine. I don't think. The moment that's the conversation, I think you are going to lose. I've not seen it work.
That is actually a very difficult part of the whole point of the whole thing, is that when you talk to someone who holds some sort of conspiracy theory as their view, very, very difficult. It's impossible to change their mind.
And I share this story sometimes when we, when we're talking about how to communicate science. I have my grandmother-in-law, is wonderful. But we didn't get started off on the right foot when I married into the family. And she, you know, so we didn't always get along. And I've been married now a long time. And when the COVID vaccine came out, she was older, so she was one of the first people to be offered it. And she has different values and beliefs than I have. So within her group, they were much more vaccine hesitant, you know, didn't think COVID was that serious, that real, didn't want to wear masks, all that. So her group was like, don't get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And she called me up, or maybe we were sitting at dinner or something, and was like, Maggie, what should I do? If Maggie, you tell me I need to get the vaccine, I'll get the vaccine.
Right.
And I said, first, I'm not a medical doctor, so do whatever your doctor,
talk to your doctor.
Yeah. But from what I read, from what I understand, as somebody who is trained in being able to read research articles and understand risks and things like that, I said, I think you should absolutely get it.
Right.
And she did, and my in-laws did as well, my mother and father-in-law. So
what changed that? And maybe you're getting to that point.
Yeah, I think the point is, she, because, you know, I was invested in the relationship and showed up, and she, you know, was kind to her, helped her, talked to her over many years of building that relationship up. She no longer viewed me not only as just an outsider in the family, but as somebody who was a scientist who was kind of definitely the other group, an outside group compared to hers. I no longer seemed like an other to her.
Right.
So I was part of her in-group in a way, despite being a scientist. And she actually then valued what I brought to the table as somebody who's a scientist. And we had built that trust with each other over many years. To then when something scary like this came, she was willing to step out and seek out good information
right.
from somebody that she trusted.
Yeah.
Not even her own medical doctor.
Right.
She asked, you know, he told her to get it and she came to me.
Yeah.
So I think we never had a conversation about COVID vaccines. I never said anything about it to her at any point in time, because that's not going to do any good.
Right.
So that's kind of what I mean when I'm talking about these conversations, just especially people you know, friends right. and family. I don't care what you do.
Yeah.
Now, there might be consequences. Like if you're during that time, if you didn't get vaccinated or you didn't want to wear a mask, we wouldn't be able to hang out with you or
right.
something.
Yeah.
So there were consequences, but at the same time, those people did their best to respect what we wanted them to do. They would wear masks and things like that, even if they wouldn't any other place. So those the conversations you're having are you're having conversations not about the actual thing.
It's
that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's like, tell me to get a vaccine without telling me to get a vaccine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and I think why I think about the story with my grandmother-in-law is because I didn't tell her and she trusted me. She actually sought out good information
mm-hmm.
and understood what was good information and who was a reliable source of information. So it wasn't me, you know, trying to shove something down her throat.
Right.
She came to that decision on her own.
Right.
And that won't always be the case. But I think it's just a really good example of you as scientists, we can get really frustrated with people who don't trust the science, but people don't respond well to frustration.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We don't respond very well to frustration. Yeah.
And so that's what I mean when I say it doesn't bother me, because it can't, otherwise you're kind of going to be in a losing battle. And I understand that these things do have serious consequences in many ways.
Yeah.
But I just can't.
I mean, you bring up a very important word, which is trust.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a lot of conspiracy theories are based on distrust, based on paranoia, they're based on some hidden group controlling something, you're already losing trust.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be trust in scientists or in government mm-hmm. or in the way the world works or in anything
mm-hmm.
really or
mm-hmm.
the way that the officiating system works in professional sports, whatever mm-hmm. it might mm-hmm. be. you're already starting from negative, below mm-hmm. zero mm-hmm. Of trust. This is mm-hmm. not going to be someone who is already neutral on trust. Mm-hmm. And so what I really love about your story is that it was years of forming a relationship, mm-hmm. forming a relationship. And so if we were to meet someone at the bar, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like you said, the man who we called Flat Earth Guy, right?
Yeah,
came in, had drinks, and we had a fun time with him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we would ever expect to change this person's mind.
No.
Zero, right? Because there's no established trust. And as it turns out, believe it or not, just a couple of days ago, I was out with friends mm-hmm. and ended up meeting a person that I'd never met before. Very lovely human person and very accomplished person, fairly educated, mm-hmm. as far as I could tell. And the topic of Flat Earth came up and, I made a joke because we're out.
And having a good time.
Having a good time, you know. And I said, I actually enjoy talking to people who believe the Earth is flat because I want to believe. I think the idea, from a romantic point of view, I think it's really cool to just have, like, live inside this dome and have everything rotate around us. Mm-hmm. It's a very romantic idea. I want to believe. And he says, let me tell you. And he proceeds to tell me about, you know, why a globe Earth is just completely wrong. And I said, do tell me more. You know, tell me more. And I kept asking questions. Mm-hmm. I felt like if we expect someone to be open-minded, to be able to change their mind on something as fundamental as whether we are on a flat surface or a round surface, then I should also try to be as open-minded as possible, that on the off chance, on the zero chance, that this person is going to give me some evidence to believe that the Earth is flat, that I would actually change my mind. But I think you know how the story ends.
I don't know.
Maybe you're now
a flat earther. Maybe this is your way of breaking.
I'll tell you what. I tried. I really did try. I really put in an effort. Yeah. I asked a lot of questions because I want to believe. And I made it very clear to him that I was not there to dissuade him from thinking the way that mm-hmm. he thought. In fact, I want him to explain to me more. I want to know. And, you know, some of the things that he was talking about, you know, looking across Lake Michigan and still being able to see Chicago. This is, you know, 40-some miles, 50 miles or so, and how, according to Curvature of the Earth, we can't see it. I said, okay, well, I don't know. I wasn't there. I lived in Chicago by the lake, mm-hmm. and sometimes you could see across when it's a clear view. And I asked the question, I said, you know, is all of our math wrong? And he said, well, some of it is.
Mm. Yeah.
I said, okay, which ones? Yeah, let's just try to just figure out what we agree on before we can start to, you know, mm-hmm. because I want to know, right? I want to believe. And I asked, you know, what? Well, think of like a right triangle, just a right triangle mm-hmm. with the right angle. And if we were on a flat surface, why is it that when I go up, I see more things? Like if I climb a ladder or if I go up on an airplane? Because I my first question was, you know, if the Earth is flat, why is it that I can't see Mount Everest? Mm-hmm. It's the tallest thing. We should be able to see it from anywhere. It should be taller than everything else. Mm-hmm. And his response, well, no, because things get smaller as they're farther away.
Okay.
And so I said, okay, then why is it that when I go up on an airplane, I can see farther away, mm-hmm. even though those points are actually farther away, mm-hmm. but, you know, on a flat Earth, that would be the hypotenuse of the triangle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his explanation was, well, there are hills in the way. I said, have you been to Indiana? We live in Indiana. And then I went back, there's not a hill in sight. And at the same time, I said, well, what about Lake Michigan? You know, we've all taken this flight from South Bend to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Very short flight.
Yeah,
we're 100 miles away. We're shorter distance, even if you fly, especially if you fly over the lake. And as soon as you go up on the airplane, you can see everything. Mm-hmm. He says, no, you can't see the curvature of the Earth. I said, I thought that just the fact that things vanish over a horizon, that means that that is the curvature. said, no, 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 it's an optical illusion. I said, okay. But then, you know what happened? And was really revealing at the very end of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that apparently this was all about a battle of good and evil.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
So this was really about a battle of good and evil. And again, I'm not trying to make fun of this person or anybody because, as you know, this is not the first time that mm-hmm. I've talked to people who believe that the earth is flat. And it always ends up as something spiritual and not something scientific.
Yeah.
This whole flat earth thing especially is really about something that is spiritual. And I said, okay, well, what does the battle of good and evil have to do with whether the earth is flat or round? There could still
be my next question.
Yeah, there could still be a battle between good and evil. I'm not even going to discount that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, there are evil people, evil whatever, your spirits even, if you want to invoke that.
Mm-hmm.
But why can't we have a battle, nice battle on a round earth? still battle
yeah.
it out,
yeah.
right?
Why is this the deciding factor? For...
Yeah, and... it really came down to, again, this idea of feeling special, feeling
yeah.
like you belong. I think the idea of the Big Bang, and I think that was actually what was said,
mm-hmm.
the Big Bang, and that somehow some big explosion scattered everything, and now here we are just on a lonely rock floating somewhere in space.
Which is a terrifying thought.
And for a lot of people, it is a very terrifying thought, and that we're not special at all. There's nothing special about us.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to find this idea actually quite liberating. The fact that we are just like out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very liberating idea for me personally, for my own reasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can
see.
Yeah, but I can see why people can see this as a very alienating and terrifying.
Yeah, it can leave you feeling very untethered.
I'm tethered to this earth. However, okay. whatever shape it takes.
No, okay, okay. I'm happy for you.
But I can see it.
Yeah.
I can see it, you know? And I said, I see it, man. I totally see it. I stopped there, but I could have said, but what does it matter what the shape of the earth is if you're still feeling alienated,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the Bible was brought up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this person knows that I've read the Bible several times.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that there is really no mention about the shape of the earth. In fact, there's something about the circle of the earth in the Bible. And I said, you know, the Bible didn't mention a lot of things. The Bible didn't mention anything about coffee or microchips or computer processors. But, you know, we work with them all the time. What do we do with these things? You know, I think that's kind of where we left the conversation, but mm-hmm. it was interesting because it was never really about the science.
Did you tell him that you were a scientist?
I think I did. Yes, I did. I did earlier on. But but again, my whole motivation, and I was not BSing this person. I really was truly trying to be as open-minded as possible because... Yeah. I always go into these conversations with the idea that if someone gives me proof or valid evidence that the earth is flat, I will be a flat earther. But that's never happened.
No.
That's never happened. And on the other side as well, there's so much more compelling proof. All of the proof tells us that the earth is a globe. And again, and this is not me trying to argue for one or the other. I'm really trying to understand why... Do people believe that? And it becomes a belief system, and it really is not about the science at all.
So then why do scientists keep trying to mm-hmm. just share correct data if we are seeing that that doesn't seem to have an impact on changing people's minds?
Yeah, yeah, this is a very important question, you know, and this really comes down to a couple of things. One of them is the three conversations, the three types of conversations. These are described by Charles Duhigg in his book, Super Communicators, a really good book that you recommended to me, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Duhigg talks about three different types of conversations. One is about facts, you mm-hmm. know, like what time are we picking up the kids? Okay, I'll meet you there for sure. The other one is about feelings. You know, it might actually have some facts in it. Like, oh, I have to go to work. But it's definitely not about I have to go to work at 8 a.m. It is about how I feel about having to go to work at 8 a.m. And then the other, the third type is about belonging, about who are we? Am I the type of person to put this lawn sign on my lawn or the other lawn sign or even a lawn sign at all, right? Am I that type of person? And so I think as scientists, we tend to really train ourselves to just talk in that first type of conversation. Facts, information, exactly. Facts, information, plots, data, 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 data. And then as we start out these conversations with people who might hold some sort of conspiracy theory, or, and it doesn't have to be a conspiracy theory, maybe they're just hesitant about taking a vaccine because they don't know how it's going to affect them and they feel scared. There's a feeling there. What we do is we just give them more and more and more information. And then they might go on to the third type of conversation. Meanwhile, we are completely blind to what's happening. We can't read the room. We can't read the type of conversation. And we just keep giving them more and more and more information. And we're not speaking the same language. We're not even having the same type of conversation at all. All we're doing is giving them more data. And if someone is terrified of flying, they are on an airplane, and you can tell them all statistics in the world about how flying is one of the safest modes of transportation, and actually driving to the airport was far less safe. They might even believe you, but they're still going to be terrified on that plane because it's a fear, and information is not going to take away fear.
Yeah, I'm terrified to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I get terrified every time I get on an airplane.
I have some information for you.
Yeah, there's very little you can do to... I'm a trained scientist, and it's difficult for me to reason my way out of that feeling.
Yeah, and I think that people think that we can just reason our way out of anything. And,
yeah, I would be... Man, yeah. If that was true,
Yeah,
so great.
I know if that was true. If I can reason my way out of all of my feelings, well... I would also not be a fully functional human being, and I don't think anybody would want to interact with me.
Yeah, but I think that third conversation, the values is really, I think it's easy to go to the emotions and say, yes, people are afraid, and that's why they might be behaving like X, Y, and Z. But the values one, I think, is really the key.
That third type of conversation about belongingness, like, and the values.
Who am I? Am I the type of person that would do X, Y, and Z? Does my group do X, Y, and Z?
Sorry, I just
And I also think that people don't always know that that's the conversation. Those are the reasons. Those thoughts don't appear as words and. When they're having those conversations.
So even if I am having that third type of conversation, I'm not thinking that I'm having this type of conversation.
I don't think so. I think...
Right. It's instinctive to just want to belong without even knowing that that's what I want.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, thinking about times in my life that's been true, and only after reflecting, it's like, oh, I made that choice because, you know... I didn't want to be on the out group. But in the moment, that's not what you're thinking about. You probably are thinking more emotionally.
Right.
And you might be able to name those emotions in that moment. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult to have those types of conversations if both parties can't really get on the same page about those.
Of course.
And I think this is not to say that we should go out having conversations with people to change their mind and like trick them. And you know, this is not like a hack. Right, for getting people to change their mind. I think it's just acknowledging that this is how humans communicate and their reasonings and motivations, which aren't always verbal.
Yes, that's very true.
So
there's really no formula for talking to people and changing their minds. And I think that's always been the myth. You're aware of this as well as I am. This idea of the information deficit model, maybe you can talk to us a little bit more about or a little bit about this informational deficit model, what it is and why it doesn't really work.
Yeah, so this is in the world of communication in general, but science communication in particular, this has come up, the information deficit model, where what is lacking is correct, accurate, engaging information And that's why we have such so much misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the solution is to put out correct information.
Right.
And maybe, you know, doing it in a more interesting, a more accessible way.
Mm-hmm.
And that will simply change people's minds. It's because they do not have the correct information.
Right. So if you just give them the information, they'll just change. If they only know.
Yeah.
If you just give them the data on climate change or on whatever. Yeah. Then they'll change their mind automatically.
Right? But, you know, as you were saying with people who, with flat earth people, mm-hmm. that's the flat earth guy, that didn't work, did it?
No. I mean, I tried not to provide a lot of information. It was just mostly asking questions. But you're right. I mean, he's got all kinds of information. Information is available. And this person is fairly well educated, a graduate degree.
So that's kind of one of the ideas, and I think it's prevalent because it seems to make the most sense, because as scientists we're like, well, yeah, if you just see the data, then of course
that
would make sense. So I think as people who care about science communication and gaining trust, this isn't the first natural step, but but we know that it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
I think if we all admit to ourselves,
mm-hmm.
we know it doesn't work because we've tried it with friends and family, right?
Right.
We've tried it, and it doesn't. If it doesn't work on a family member, then why would it work for the, more broadly,
right,
for the general public? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, so just simply giving people more information and providing them with plots and
mm-hmm.
and graphs and infographics,
mm-hmm.
it might help, but it's not going to change people's minds, especially when they're holding these misinformed or, you know, conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And so then there's also the idea that maybe if people are smarter, you know,
mm-hmm.
that this idea that science comprehension thesis
mm-hmm.
Argument, that
mm-hmm.
Maybe people believe in conspiracy theories or have certain views because they're not educated enough. So one is not informed enough. Now they're not educated enough, or they don't have like the math literacy
mm-hmm.
To be able to comprehend the data, right?
Yeah.
But there's, again, research against that.
There is. There is a paper that came out in 2017
mm-hmm.
that kind of took into account all these things, like our, you know, specifically numeracy, which is basically mm-hmm. math literacy, ability to understand and interpret data, and number problems. So participants were evaluated on their ability to interpret data, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and ranked. And then these participants were shown, half of them were shown one set of data and the other half were shown a different set of data.
Mm-hmm.
The first set of data showed that the use of a skin cream increased the rash. So it made the rash worse.
Mm-hmm.
Other set of people were shown the opposite. So the skin cream actually made the rash better.
Right.
So one was treatment was effective, one was treatment was not effective.
And this is all made up data.
Made up data.
Just to see if people can interpret it correctly.
Yeah.
Right.
So as expected, as people's numeracy,
mm-hmm.
so their ability to, how they were evaluated with their ability to look at numbers
mm-hmm.
increased, the percentage of people who got the interpreted the data correctly went up.
Okay. So the better you are at math, the more you can interpret the data and tell us whether the cream actually worked or made things worse.
Right. So
okay.
As expected.
Uh-huh.
However, the interesting part of this study, they took those same participants,
mm-hmm.
and instead of framing this made-up data as a skin cream and rash,
mm-hmm.
they framed it around gun reform, gun policies,
mm-hmm.
and the impact that those have on crime.
Mm.
So a very political issue.
Right.
And so in addition to having the participants evaluated on their numeracy, they were also evaluated on their conservative or I think they did call it liberal.
Liberal, conservative, right. Views.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a group that had more conservative values and policy ideas and then a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they were shown this data, group was shown data that increasing gun control
mm-hmm.
decreases crime.
Right.
Which would be more in line with liberal
values. Whatever views. Yeah.
The other showed that increasing gun control actually increased crime.
Uh-huh.
And this time, instead of numeracy being associated with answering the correct question, answering the question correctly, as your numeracy went up, you were more likely to get the answer wrong if it went against your political ideology.
Wow. So if the data looked like they were against your political view, you went against the data, even if you had the skills to interpret the data. Mm-hmm. So it's not really about being smart, in quotes.
Right. So, for example, if you are somebody who believes that we need gun reform and that that will decrease crime, which would be a more liberal policy. Yeah. They were shown data that showed that gun control actually increases increases crime rates.
Yeah.
They would still interpret that as it decreases.
Wow.
Gun crime. Yeah. So and that in and of itself is interesting that phenomenon happened in the study. But the fact that it got worse as you got more literate in data analysis, essentially, was very shocking.
That is actually, I think, the shocking part, is that the so-called smarter you are, in quotes, the more wrong you got it, and the more you stuck to your guns,
but,
on
your
political view.
But if that data set did agree with your political ideologies, then you followed the trend of increased numeracy, increased your chance of getting the answer correct.
Yeah.
So only when it went against your political ideology did that numeracy seem to that idea really get out of whack.
To have that gap. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily knowledge, and it's not necessarily math skills. We seem to be just entrenched in our own views somehow, and that has to do with the group that we belong to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
When you first showed me this day, and there's also a video that we'll include in our show notes.
Yeah, Veritasium video.
Yeah, that breaks
excellent
this down.
Veritasium video.
Yeah, because it's super interesting. And again, I think this is something that we as humans know to be true,
right?
That this is how we're going to behave. So the fact that it's shocking is not, and I'm like, of course, we're never going to go against our group. To do so would mean there has to be a really good reason for it.
Right.
And just don't do it. We don't do it.
So there are ways that you can actually just look at the data and make an interpretation, even if it goes against your beliefs, but that's less likely, is what the paper is saying. It is just less likely.
And if you're thinking about how do we get accurate science and get people to support public policies that are scientifically backed, that's the question we're trying to answer. So is it that we just give more information? Do we just give more education? That might be a component, and I think both of those things are important.
Right.
But it seems like the larger factor is how do we get people to get out of this us versus them mentality when it comes to scientists versus everybody else?
That is very difficult, and it is definitely a component. Obviously, we want people to have the right information. So we want people to have the math literacy.
Yeah.
But there's still that challenge, as you say.
And I also, to be clear, this is not just a conservative versus liberal, right? There's plenty of conservative, people who would identify as conservative, who are very pro a lot of scientifically backed policies.
Right.
And there are tons of liberals who tend to be, the more pro-science crowd, if we're simplifying. Tons of liberal hippies who think that science is, big pharma's out to get you and things
right.
like
there,
that.
There's conspiracies on both sides.
This
Absolutely.
Is not a political issue,
yeah.
but it does. There are divides that this is just one way to kind of separate people into two groups, essentially. Yeah. So this isn't like a one of these. Is
one better. Of these is no, there's not.
Both have issues with not trusting science and not supporting good policies.
There's actually really good data on this one as well.
Oh, yeah?
Exactly what you're saying. When it comes to things like climate change, for example, mm-hmm. right? Again, it's not really the education level that tells you whether you think it's a hoax or you think it's actually something that needs to have something done about it. It is, again, your political affiliation. That's mm-hmm. what determines what you believe in. On the same thing about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, even though overwhelmingly science says that GMOs are safe mm-hmm. to consume, there is this idea that is mostly on the liberal side of the spectrum that says that GMOs are bad, mm-hmm. even though there's really not a lot of evidence for that, right? There mm-hmm. might be some things here and there, but overwhelmingly, again, the science supports that GMOs are, for the most part, safe to consume, right? Safe to consume. But again, the divide here is politics or political views or yeah. liberal versus conservative. So one side, it's the climate change debate or gun control, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. The other side is GMOs. You know, the people who would call themselves liberals and believe in science, they're actually not listening to the science mm-hmm. on GMOs. Again, mm-hmm. I'm not here to promote GMOs, but they're generally safe to consume, regardless of the policies, right? We're not talking about the policies. We're talking about the safety of consuming an apple that is genetically modified. It's yeah. not going to turn you into a mutant whatever with you know, antennas or I don't know what people believe.
Yeah. I don't know. The thing with GMOs is always an interesting one to me because before I entered into the world of science and became a scientist, I heard about GMOs. I was a little bit of a more granola-y than I maybe am now and was kind of, you know, GMOs. We know GMOs, they're bad.
Bad, yeah.
But now that I know what it actually is,
yeah.
and I have, you know, in my time in the lab, made genetic modifications to things. I'm
right.
like, this is something that's just, like, this is not this crazy, mm-hmm. You know,
this is not this brave new world.
No, this is something that's a really cool tool.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's not necessarily about getting information that it's safe. We know that, you know, they can't change people's minds. That's not the best way to change people's minds. But I do think showing people what scientists actually do and what the science actually, like the scientific process and not giving them data about, maybe I'm not making 100% sense, but I thought it was so cool that you can just genetically modify these things.
It is super cool. Yeah.
And it wasn't about, then I became interested in learning more because I'm like, oh, now I see what they're doing.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily, I think that way of communicating science can be impactful in getting people interested in the basic science of it all.
Yeah.
Like, how do you actually genetically modify something?
Right.
I remember learning about, was it Dolly the sheep?
Dolly, yes, that was cloned.
And
yeah,
that and seemed like the most
yeah.
far-fetched, yeah. you know, the old ladies at church getting all up in an uproar yeah. about this.
Sign of the times.
Sign of the times yeah. thing. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, that was obviously a scientific feat. But I'm like, it's just this idea of cloning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Identically. I have stuff going right now that I'm genetically modifying.
You've cloned, yeah, exactly.
And cloned right. and all that.
It's much easier than people think it is. I think the word itself has taken on something that it is not in popular culture. And so, that is, again, ripe field for conspiracies.
Yeah, so I think it is on the science. Like, I think those are the types of conversations that are actually more effective at maybe getting people to consider that maybe their conspiracy theories mm-hmm. aren't actually conspiracy theories. If you don't want to eat GMOs, that's fine.
Yeah.
Right. But just understanding how cool science actually is, I think, can be effective.
Yeah. And this is the idea that the more you learn about something, the less of a mystery it becomes.
Yeah.
You kind of shine a light on it. It's like going into a dark room.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to be scared about something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shadow here, mm-hmm. a shadow there, a sound there, a creak here. And then you turn on the light. All of a sudden, it's just a coat and a hat and a bed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you're like, this is,
mm-hmm.
You see the reality of it. It's no longer scary. And I think
yeah.
you and I have the unique opportunity to be working in labs to see kind of how the sausage gets made. And you're mm-hmm. like, this is pretty basic stuff, guys. This is nothing. We're scared of these words. And I think, again, popular culture, movies, talking about cloning and, you know, cloning other people and cloning yourself, and mm-hmm. which is somewhat far-fetched.
And I mean, there is times where it would be scary if we were starting to clone stuff. Like, mm-hmm. we're in my lab, we work with TB. We don't usually study TB direct. We use a different species that is like a model organism because it's a lot safer. But we have an actual tuberculosis strain. It's the vaccine strain. So it has been genetically modified.
Right.
So that it is not as dangerous.
It's not going to kill you. Yeah. Right.
But we are not allowed to take that strain and make any genetic modifications to it.
No, you can't.
Because then we could accidentally turn it back into a really severe
disease-causing pathogen.
So right now, we can handle it, and we still treat it very seriously, because if you accidentally poke yourself or infect yourself, you're TB positive then. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to make you sick, because it's
what they use to actually give you the vaccine. Yeah, so it's a much weakened
It has been genetically modified.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Specifically for that purpose.
But then now we are not allowed to do anything else to it. Right?
And that's probably a good thing.
That we don't know what we could unleash. So there are times where those things can be serious. But the majority of the time, mm-hmm. and I think if we can talk to people and say, hey, all these things are not that scary. Mm-hmm. Then we say, but this thing, this is actually something we should be concerned about.
Right.
X, Y, Z?
No.
No.
Yeah. If you're going to be afraid of something, at least be afraid of the real scary stuff that's out there in the world. Right. There is some really, really scary stuff out there.
Yeah. Or, you know, another example that I really like that you've used is you kind of, we have a paper on glyphosate.
Yeah.
We made a biosensor for glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup.
Yes.
And there's been lots of buzz over the years about this causing cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And evidence really isn't there that it's
kind of shaky, yeah.
But there are a lot of concerns that glyphosate can have huge implications on our microbiome.
Gut bacteria.
And our gut bacteria. Yeah. And the evidence does actually suggest that might be a bigger concern.
But cancer is so scary.
I know, but I'm saying...
Yeah.
You know,
and that's why.
But saying no, you shouldn't worry about it, is not as effective as saying, you know, here actually we can. You're right to be worried, but you're worried about the wrong things.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm derailing this conversation.
I think this really goes back to what conspiracies are really about. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy theories are there to pass the blame and to really kind of, in a way, to ignore the problem.
Yeah.
And to justify feeling helpless.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just gonna say it out there.
Yeah.
If I keep thinking that, you know, my team or my work team at work is always getting dumped on and not getting enough of a raise and that whatever, maybe I'm really dodging the blame for me not working hard enough, right?
Yeah.
There might actually be a conspiracy against me. I'm this is hypothetical. I love where I work. This is hypothetical. But, you know, it's about passing the blame, that I can't do anything about it because there's some evil people in charge who are just going to keep me down. The man's going to keep me down or whatever it is. And I think there is an element of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's just be mindful of the right things, the real scary things that are out there. And is there corruption out there? Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And within science,
And within science, too. Absolutely. Everywhere. There is corruption. But making up stories to justify why I'm always going to be where I am and, you know, in quote, oppressed or whatever it is, right? That people are doing this to control us and to, that is just passing the blame and that is missing the point, I think. So what do we do? I mean, it's very hard to argue with people who are conspiracy theorists.
I think we should stop arguing with them.
You think so?
I think so. I think that I think there's much more effective conversations to have that aren't arguing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we don't have conversations.
So what about like finding things that we both like pets, for example?
Yeah, that's a great starting
point. I have a dog and that other person has a dog. And
Yeah.
I mean, you said that you really never talked to your grandmother-in-law about vaccines or science.
Yeah.
She knew you were a scientist, but you guys talked about other things. Like, I don't know. What did you talk about?
Let's see. What did we talk about? Mm-hmm. Oh, I talked
about. And is it appropriate to talk about on this podcast?
No, what was that TV show? I can't remember.
The Golden Girls?
No, he was like a detective, but he was like, oh, Columbo.
Columbo, of course.
Yeah, she loves Columbo.
Yeah, who doesn't?
So we talk about Columbo, we talk about her. Oh, she makes a really good chocolate mint pudding for Christmas.
Food, can always relate on food.
Yeah, family heirlooms. I asked her a lot about her family and pieces, you know, that were important to her. And yeah, I think as soon as you start having conversations, finding commonality with people, you start to break down that divide of us versus them.
Yeah.
Which seems obvious, but we're not all that different.
I think we all
really want the same things in life. I think all humans really do want the same things. And so once you find that ability to have common ground, sometimes the conversation about the thing never even has to happen. Maybe you're not the person that changes their mind.
Right.
Maybe they go and you've just kind of primed them to go out and talk to somebody else or get curious in a different way.
Or at least not be afraid of a scientist.
Yeah. I think scientists, we are 100% at fault for having that us versus them.
100%?
Well, I think we are, no. We, 100% of us are responsible for this in some way. All of us are responsible for this. And maybe not always intentionally, but we really isolate ourselves.
For sure.
And I think it's really on us to take some of those first steps towards meeting other people and stop. I know we were kind of joking about the reptile people or whatever, but I'm really tired of scientists and researchers talking poorly about people who do believe, even if it's not a conspiracy thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's so aggravating to me.
Yeah, and talking down to people.
And these are not stupid people.
Right.
And they are kind, good people who really want to be safe.
Right.
And I get very frustrated. And that's why I said at the beginning, I don't get bothered because it doesn't serve anybody to get upset about it.
Right. So you're saying I don't get worked up on about it because that is just going to drive people away even more from science and scientists. That is a form of talking down to people. And just like that, you've lost their trust.
And I grew up raised in an environment that did believe a lot of these conspiracy theories and had very anti-science views. And so I know what it's like to be on the other side. And let me tell you what doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, I've had an argument for every argument.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, what actually got me to, I probably still believe a lot of crazy things.
Well, Princess Diana, of course. Yeah.
But what, you know, people always ask me, well, how did you
make that switch?
And I really, there was not a single moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was years and years of just talking to people, exploring things, staying curious, people being nice to me, interacting with people that I thought were on the outside of my group.
And
like, oh, they're just normal, nice people. And so it's not like one argument over drinks is going to change somebody's mind. This is a long haul process.
So some of the things that really catch my attention in what you're saying are talking to somebody outside of your group, outside of your group.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that I have learned a lot by talking to people who believe in these conspiracy theories. They have not been able to change my mind, unfortunately, because I would really love to believe that the earth is flat, but it's not.
Yeah.
That there's some sort of firmament or dome or whatever it is, but there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's been nice to meet these people. It's really been lovely. Mm-hmm. And to just talk about their feelings and how they're afraid. They don't want to feel alone in this very, very vast universe. And I think we all can kind of share that on mm-hmm. some level for some of us, like myself. I think that's very liberating. It's be like, I'm free.
Well, have at it.
I'm free. But I can relate. I can say, yes, I understand. Nobody wants mm-hmm. to feel insignificant. Nobody wants to feel insignificant. Mm-mm. There's also the role of humility. And I mm-hmm. think that throughout this conversation that I described today and other conversations, I don't think that the other person that I was talking to ever felt, you know, like I was speaking down to them, because I really was just asking a whole lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And I would stop every now and then and say, listen, I'm not trying to put you down. I just really want to know what's going on in your mind, mm-hmm. in your as a human being. And I was not BSing this person. I was really saying, because it's true. I want to know what's going on. This is another human being. That is such a precious thing.
Yeah,
we are all very, very precious, however you want to take that.
Yeah.
And to be able to have a communion with somebody else that you disagree with, I think that is what makes life what it is. And I don't want to be just surrounded by a bunch of people that I agree with all the time. Not that I'm out there to look for conflict. I'm out there to look for ways to learn, new ways to learn and new mm-hmm. things to learn, even if it's things I don't believe in, even if it's things that I think are wild. But what else gives spice to life than wild stories? We love stories.
Yeah, like I was telling you earlier, mm-hmm. Before this, I got super interested in the Illuminati when I was in high school.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell us more about this.
It was a long time ago. But I was like, I wasn't trying to like learn about it because I wanted to believe it was true. But I'm like, well, it's pretty crazy.
That's a cool story.
Interesting, yeah, cool yeah. story.
Right. The what is it? The eye and the...
The pyramid
on the dollar and the, yeah, and the Freemasons.
That was a lifetime ago that I just dove headfirst into it. Yeah. And
human sacrifices.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kind of yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think it's okay to learn about other things.
Of course.
And I
of
think,
course.
In fact, I encourage it.
I encourage it too.
And, yeah, we scientists should not forget our humanity and treating people with dignity when we're interacting with them.
Dignity is very important. And what is the role of humility in all of this?
A big role, I think. Yeah. Isn't there some research actually?
Yeah. Papers just came out.
Humility and scientists. I haven't read all the details yet. But
I think basically, and we'll provide the link, but basically I believe that it said that when scientists were perceived to be more humble, mm-hmm. They actually, people were able to trust them more.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Instead of like, take this or you're going to die. And if you don't listen to me, you're stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not that never really does it. If I tell that to my kids and they're my kids, they're going to be like, nope, sorry.
Yeah. Not today.
And I think there's, again, the importance of stories. You know, the one thing that I think conspiracy theories have that we don't have as scientists is stories.
There's some good stories.
And I wish that we really bring storytelling in our science narrative, because I'm not saying we should make up stories. I'm saying there are some amazing stories out there.
Yeah.
That we just take those off, mm-hmm. and all we do is just present information. And, you know, the example that I like to use when we're doing our science communication workshop is the famous story of the boy who cried wolf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately, that book is not about the biology of wolves or anything mm-hmm. like that. It's really about the consequences of lying. And I can tell my kids not to lie all day long.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tell them that story, that's going to resonate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as scientists, we stop telling stories because somehow mm-hmm. we feel like that's inferior to the data. And mm-hmm. in a way, yes, we have to believe the data because mm-hmm. the numbers ultimately are what are going to decide what the model actually is and what the theories really are. But we tend to forget that there are amazing stories behind the discoveries, even if it's stories about the people that are involved. There's some crazy stories about the people, but also just stories about like the universe and how huge it is, how big and how vast it is, how toxic some of the things that are in life are, like these bacteria, these viruses and toxins.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've really taken away the stories. We've taken away the humility.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's my contribution to this conversation.
Yeah, I think there's many more things that can be discussed, and just be nice to people.
Be nice.
And go find somebody, and talk to them and find something in common with them.
Find something in common with them. Find someone that you disagree with, mm-hmm. and find something in common with them.
Yeah.
How about that?
I think that sounds great.
I want to give a shout out to Ahmed Al-Ghandour. He's a famous YouTuber mm-hmm. in the Middle East, for a lot of the references that I was able to look up for this two-part mm-hmm. Podcast, these two episodes. And I hope that we've learned a little bit about conspiracy theories and just how science works and what we can do to talk to our friends and families mm-hmm. and to look inside all of us to yeah. see what conspiracy theories we hold.
And all of our non-scientist listeners, mm-hmm. You can believe the Earth's flat. Ask us, and if you want, you know, I think people don't know that if you want, a scientist will be very happy to talk about science.
All the time.
So if you got questions, go find your local scientist.
Find your local scientist.
I've not really met any that wouldn't be happy to chat with anybody who has questions and get to know them. So mm-hmm. go find your local scientist. Or if you have a question, you can write us too.
Yes. Make sure you write your questions on a crisp $100 bill and send it to us by mail. Or a gold bar, that works too.
No, please do not do that. I feel like that would feed some conspiracy theories about Big Pharma, even though neither of us work for Big Pharma.
No, I wish they were paying me, but they're not, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, this has been lovely.
This has been great.
It has been wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Sophia.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.